Crisis communications is a complex science. There's a lot more to it than simply answering media or partner questions during a stressful situation. This series of edited discussions about crisis communication theory and practice is intended to help you refine your ability to manage, respond to, and ultimately survive a crisis. I'm Robert Johnson, your host for this conversation presented by the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials and the National Public Health Information Coalition. Each module considers a different aspect of crisis communications management, as explained by an expert or experts in the field. These discussions are produced to summarize the written and visual materials that accompany each topic. In this conversation, our focus is on inclusive communication. Susan Laird is a communicator, a nurse, and a scientist. She also teaches public health professionals how they can make their words more inclusive and thus more effective. The conversation is based on a presentation that you can find as part of this module. It includes a recording of the live presentation complete with audience questions. Now, our discussion with Susan Laird from the CDC. We're talking about inclusive communications, that is, speaking and communicating in a way that all groups can feel represented. Why is that so important?
If we want our communications to be well received, we need to be more inclusive in our language so that others actually want to listen to what we have to say.
And anyone can do this on their own? You don't need to be part of any group or organized effort?
When I talk to others about this work, I say that it starts with them as individuals. It starts with me. It starts with you. So first we have to take a step back and be willing to listen to the why part. Why is this important? What words have we used our entire lives that might just be hurtful to others? For example, when we refer to a person as their disease, you know, like Susan is a diabetic versus Susan is a person living with diabetes, we're almost blaming the person for the situation they're in.
It sounds easy enough, but don't we have to make an effort if we want to get this right?
It's not a new concept that we need to think about how what we're saying or doing is impacting somebody else. It's just that we have to pay a little bit more attention to it because language and culture changes. And now it changes a lot more quickly than it ever has. So if we want to be effective in this space, we need to know that to start with.
So where do we start?
Using a health equity lens means being intentional, inclusive, getting input from your intended audiences. We have to be mindful that systemic social and health inequities have increased the risk of getting sick, having poor health, and having worse outcomes. Our public health work is much more likely to be successful when we recognize the diversity of the communities we're trying to reach.
Maybe give us some examples of what you're talking about. Start with the phrase target populations.
We've used that forever. We could say population of focus. It's the same intention, the same end result as far as the community we want to focus on, but we're using less offensive words. Instead of saying the homeless, you could say people experiencing homelessness. It takes away that unintentional blaming piece that we have in a lot of the language we've used for a long time. Instead of saying a person is confined or restricted to a wheelchair or wheelchair bound, you could just say person who uses a wheelchair. So that's the person first application. Instead of high risk groups, you could say groups that are at a higher risk for whatever. And again, this reframing deflects the blaming posture.
You say the answer to this one is not complicated. Rather, it is extremely simple.
Does someone who has difficulty hearing want to be called deaf or hard of hearing? I don't know. Ask them, you know, what's your preference? So it, first of all, acknowledges that you care enough to ask. And as I said, nobody has ever objected. But I get that a lot as far as people asking after I do a presentation of some kind, you know, how do you go about starting those conversations? I think you have to kind of dive in. I think you have to be willing to say, I don't know. I want to understand. I want to do better. Will you help me with that?
Does the process require humility or courage on our part?
It takes both. It takes that self-reflection piece where you say, you know, I thought I was pretty smart, you know, thought I've been doing, I thought I was thoughtful. I'm an ER nurse, you know, I communicated with people when they're at their most vulnerable, right? So there we go. There's the vulnerable. And there are the other concepts of trying to say the right thing. And the other issue that interferes at times is time itself. We speak in a shorthand in the healthcare universe and in the public health universe that we need to rethink. Sometimes that shorthand has been the way that we move in this space, and we need to stop, take that moment to just hesitate and say, is this really what I want to say?
Do you think in most cases people really do want to be respectful?
For the most part, people don't start out wanting to be offensive. Now, as I said, a lot of things have changed in the last few years here, but I don't think people start that way. So it's really important to remember, again, that we don't all come from the same place, and not everyone is going to buy into this work. Not everybody's going to love you. The best we can do is share our perspectives and hope people will try.
What happens if we do this?
We started talking about it in a more real fashion. We're not mincing words. We're not dancing around the subject. We're trying to be very direct. I think the directness helps. That doesn't, you know, as I said, because it's direct doesn't mean it's not thoughtful. It just means that we go right to the point. Here's the problem. Here's a solution. This is one thing we can do to make it better. If you grew up with extreme prejudices, I'll use an example from my own family. I've talked about this before. My father was in World War II. He served in the Pacific. And his entire life, he absolutely hated Japanese. And there was absolutely nothing that any of us could say that would change his mind. There was no changing his mind. That was a fixed point in his life where he had an unpleasant experience, and it would never, he would not care anything about this work as it applied to Japanese. I think we have to start from a point where we begin to understand that people come from their own unique perspective. So do I want to change your mind? Well, I tried to change his mind, tried to get him to broaden his scope. But will that be successful? Not everywhere. It's not going to happen. But we can try to say, okay, maybe you don't like this particular population, and maybe you have reason in your own mind that works. It doesn't make sense to me. So here's the way I want to think. We have to start from the core where everybody else already is. You know, you can't go in and say everybody's going to be open to this, because they're not. And it doesn't make them a bad person. It doesn't make them unwilling to try some of the things that we suggest. It simply says, okay, I acknowledge where you are, and I see that you're not going to change your mind, but how about this? Would you think about this? I think that's the best we can do, and what means that we're all going to have to be understanding, and we're going to have to be a little forgiving. You know, sometimes we think because we all work in public health that we all are on the same page. We're not. We're just not. I mean, CDC has, you know, how many thousand people? It's bigger than most small cities. And people there are from every different background and every different mindset. And that's not bad, but it's opportunity. So we have to kind of think of it that way, as opposed to saying, you know, people like my father are just bad people or wrong, or, you know, it's not like that. It's his experience, but it doesn't have to be mine. It doesn't have to be my daughter's or my grandchildren's.
How do you measure success with your work, raising these concerns with audiences the way you do?
That we've caught more flies with honey, that the approach that we've taken is one of suggestion and invitation, that we've had people at least tune in. You know, they may not buy the whole thing. As I said before, not everybody's going to love you. But the more people that we can reach, I feel like we're doing our best work in getting out there and inviting you to join us and say, you know, we're looking at this. We're thinking about it. We're trying to do better, because it's important. We have to realize that the world is changing and culture is always going to rule. culture changes and with it, language changes. We need to keep up and we need to be out front so that we're doing the right things and that we're open to continuing to make the changes as they happen, to be front and center. I think we have to make the effort to lead this work.
You've been listening to one of six discussions about crisis communications available on demand via this platform. Make sure to listen to all of them. Each considers a different aspect of the science and art of messaging during an emergency. Also, don't forget to engage the other resources included in this training. That way, you'll be prepared when a crisis comes calling. On behalf of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials and the National Public Health Information Coalition, I'm Robert Johnson. Thanks for listening, and be well.